The next case on the en banc calendar this afternoon, or this morning, I should say, is Deepak Desai versus the State of Nevada, case number 64591. Ms. Forsman, there you go.
I am.
Please proceed.
Freddie Forsman on behalf of the co-counsel Richard Wright. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I could, Your Honor.
Yes, ma'am.
The danger of an unjust conviction in a case like this is high anyway because of the high profile nature of the case and the amount of outrage generated by the case. When there is an experimental prosecution, as it was here, the danger of convicting a man for a conduct that he didn't know was criminal until after it was committed is very high. In order to understand what happened here, I usually wouldn't go into the facts as deeper, but I think there's such confusion about what the real conduct was that could lead to the Hep C infections. And so I provided you with a smaller version of this chart just to go quickly through what the problems are, because they become very confused when you read the brief. So go, wait a minute, can you reuse a syringe? What if you only reuse a syringe on the same patient? Is that going to create infection? So I want to go through this just very quickly to set up the issues, because I think the facts do matter in terms of analyzing what happened here. Let me start with just going through some of the undisputed facts. Reuse of syringes on a single patient cannot transmit infection. This is undisputed. Every expert, every CDC person, every health department person said, if you reuse a syringe on a single vial of propofol, you cannot transmit infection. Okay. Second undisputed fact, use of vials of propofol on more than one patient cannot transmit infection by itself. Okay. It is only the combination of those two practices that result in the transmission of the infection. And that's important because often the state will refer to, well, you can't reuse syringes. And Dr. Desai knew because, you know, somebody said they were reusing syringes. Well, that's only true if what he knew was they were reusing syringes in combination with reuse of vials, and there is no testimony in this record that he knew that. That's why I'm emphasizing it. But this chart, I think, helps a little bit because if you start on the very left, you take a clean needle, a new vial, a clean syringe, you insert it into the propofol, you inject the patient, and the patient is infected. Then you go back into the vial with either the same, with the same syringe, whether you change the needle or not, the testimony was. So you go back into the syringe, there is a danger that the infection, that it will now taint that vial. Now, if you go back into the syringe and you draw out the propofol and you re-inject the same patient and in the 20 cc vials, the vial is all gone, you throw away the vial, everything's fine, nobody gets infected. If instead what happens, which is what happened with only two of all of the CRNAs, the nurses and anesthetists in this clinic, if what happens instead is that as Mathis apparently did and as Lakeman apparently did, is you go back into the vial, you reuse the syringe, then you take that same vial, even if you change the needle. And that, this chart, by the way, is from the CDC, from an article by Melissa Schaefer, who testified at the trial. You go back into the vial, the infection is now in the vial. If you use that vial, even if you've tried to employ negative pressure, which is what these two older CRNAs said they did, because they felt it reduced the risk, back in the vial, now you've got a tainted vial. And if that vial then is used on a subsequent patient, and this is what the whole investigation concluded, is that that's when the infection is transmitted. Now, the risk, the 50 cc vials are clearly not a single patient vial. They come with a spike that allows you to go back into it. It's too much propofol, which is likely the reason for the large verdict in the civil case, because it was the manufacturer, undisputed facts, even as the manufacturer, who suggested to the charge nurse, Jeffrey Kruger, that they use 50 cc vials. You only use 50 cc vials? Jeff Kruger testified, and nobody refuted this, that Dr. Desai, when he went to Dr. Desai to say, should we get some 50 cc vials? And Dr. Desai said, ask the CRNAs. because all of the doctors testified that they relied upon the training and experience of the CRNAs for however they were doing the dosing, and they did it in different ways, which is telling. They did it in different ways. They have some of them pre-filled syringes and that sort of thing. There is no price difference, two more undisputed facts, there is no price difference per milliliter between the 20cc vials and the 50cc vials. The state tried to fill their gap of knowledge and intent by suggesting that there was, that Dr. Desai must have been using 50cc vials because there was a price difference. Well, unfortunately, they were using, and the prosecutor had to apologize to the jury during a final argument, because they were using price dates from from a year apart. And if you look at Exhibit W1, which is in the supplemental appendix, pages 5 and 6, you'll see that there's no price difference between the 50cc vials and the 20cc vials. And all 10 witnesses, they called every former and current, or the current at the time of the investigation, a nurse anesthetist, and nobody testified that they could not get as much propofol or as many syringes as they needed. Nobody testified to that. So that's where we are. The state, let me just say that it, and then I want to move to the confrontation issue because I think it's important. But when I say an experimental prosecution, what I'm talking about is, if you look at the state's brief, page 41, the state says the purpose of second-degree felony murder created by statute is to abrogate the need for mens rea, as it is provided by the felonious intent inherent in committing the felony. The problem here is that the felonies we're talking about are unintentional felonies. They're neglect of a patient and reckless endangerment. So trying to substitute mens rea, this is how mens rea in this case got so watered down.
So could Dr. Desai have been prosecuted for involuntary manslaughter as opposed to second degree murder?
Possibly, he wasn't. Problem, of course, as this court knows, because you've warned repeatedly over the years about the dangers of using second-degree felony murder, because it could be used in order to be able to create a penalty that the underlying felony didn't intend, and because the legislature has never signed off on that, this is a problem. And so when they decided to go with second-degree felony murder, they decided that the penalty that was already provided for death of a patient as a result of neglect of the patient was apparently not sufficient, even though that's the one that the legislature chose in NRS 200.495. And so when you start watering down, and it's I have read, I think, every second-degree felony murder case I could find. I read the very few number of cases where there was any kind of criminal prosecution at all before have been a number of these hepatitis C outbreaks based upon injection practices. Very, very, very few criminal prosecutions at all. No murder prosecutions. And you finding a case, even not involving patient neglect, where you've got aiding and abetting a non-intentional crime as the felonious basis for second-degree felony murder, which is counting on, as the state puts it, counting on not having to prove any mens rea at all, according to the state. I couldn't find another jurisdiction which would expand the second-degree felony murder, the encompassing felony murder, this kind of unintentional felonies basically aiding and abetting. Because one thing you don't have to grapple with here factually is that the state has already conceded that Dr. Desai was never a direct actor in this case. We're not suggesting that he was never a direct actor, and in a minute I'll get into that with the secondary felony murder, because that's a big problem. The confrontation clause violations are serious, and they weren't necessary. The judge was surprised when the state decided to bring a surrogate coroner onto the stand, as opposed to the coroner who, from the Philippines, who actually could answer questions with regard to the coroner's report, the autopsy report, as well as the death certificate. The state will argue, let me start with the death certificate. The state will argue that the death certificate is not testimonial because, of course, the Philippines must have the same rules that we do with regard to official documents. Well, there was no testimony on that. There's a ribbon at 923-537. You'll find the death certificate, and it's got a seal on it, and it's got a ribbon on it, and it's got stuff from the council that, because it's a foreign document, nowhere in there is there information with regard to the death certificate that would show you that it is non-testimonial. And as we pointed out in our briefs, there are a number of courts that find that death certificates are testimonial and that you must bring them, particularly in this case, because what happened was is that the death certificate carried two causes of death. This isn't a case where you can resolve the case based upon the it wouldn't matter. Many murder cases, that's going to be true because there isn't any dispute as to the cause of death. Here, there is. In fact, the defense even put on a doctor to talk about how he had reviewed all of the records and he could not determine that the cause of death was a result of the infection. So the cause of death is definitely an issue. And the surrogate coroner got up on the stand and explained the death certificate. Well, here's what they meant by the two. They didn't really mean that it wasn't caused by the hep C infection. The surrogate got on the stand and testified to the results of toxicology that she hadn't conducted, she hadn't seen, and she testified to those to say that that there was hep C infection present, and then she explained that more, and so there are definite problems with the surrogate coroner in the death certificate. But this was complicated even more so by the fact that the state chose to put on the video deposition of Mr. Miera, who had died by the time of trial. And when they chose to put on that video deposition, they chose to do it in such a way that they could decide that it could be put on with the defense being prevented from adequately cross-examining Mr. Miller. This is not a preliminary hearing case where you've got a lawyer who has already asked all the questions, or a case in which you've got the person up on the stand and the person is not responding, which happens sometimes. But you've got the person up on the stand, the fact finder can look at the person as they're responding to the defense counsel's questions, and then the fact finder is able to assess it. But the state makes the argument in their brief that Mr. Reich had sufficient opportunity to cross-examine because he had 63 questions and 63 opportunities to ask the right questions. So I'm running out of time. There's so many issues in this case. If there are any questions at this point, otherwise I'd like to reserve my time.
There is one question I wanted to pose to you, and it involves the Sharma rule.
Yes.
And the analysis that the court might consider in resolving the aider and abettor theories in that connection. There seems to be some choices or options available to the court concerning that analysis, and I wanted to hear your comments with respect to the analysis that would cause the court to reverse endangerment and the other counts.
Neglect of patient,
yes,
and endangerment.
Because
counts.
They're kind of foundational with respect to the second degree murder issue as well.
They are foundational, Your Honor. This court has not been presented with this question before as to how to apply our aiding and abetting jurisprudence to crimes with unintentional consequences. Mm-hmm. I could tell you it just can't happen. It's an oxymoron, which has been some of the reaction that I've gotten from lawyers that I've talked to. I have to tell you that I believe that probably the resolution that is suggested by the law review article, which we cited and which this court cited in Sharma, is probably the better option, is probably the more realistic option, which is that you must prove that the defendant intended that the conduct that the conduct which ultimately resulted in the unintended consequence and if the defendant intended that that conduct be committed, then the accessory rule can be applied to these kinds of trials. These kinds of charges, I'm not ready to suggest to the court that you could never have an aider and abettor to reckless conduct. I don't see this court as accepting that. So that would be my suggestion, and I think the law review article makes a very good case for that. Well, the problem in this case, of course, is that when you look at it, there is no evidence of that. There's a lot of atmospheric evidence. That's not evidence of actual intent, because as you know, aiding and abetting requires a really specific intent that the person commit the crime, not negligence.
So if the court were to clarify this area and adopt that approach as suggested in the law review, these counts and perhaps the second degree murder count should be retried because the jury wasn't instructed on that theory.
You can retry it, Your Honor. I think you may have a double jeopardy problem with that. It may be that if the resolution, if your resolution and what you find in your opinion is that there was insufficient evidence of intent in order to support this three-part dance to second degree felony murder, then I don't think those counts could be retried.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay.
May it please the Court, Michael Stadler on behalf of the State of Nevada in this case. I think I will, if I can, I know there were many issues that were raised in the briefing, but I will start with the question and the answer that Justice just addressed with defense counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the issue of aiding and abetting and specific intent, how it all melts together in these types of crimes, whether it can be applied, not applied, or whatever. Specific intent related to this, the general intent crimes that we're talking about here, as opposed to in Sharma, specific intent crime, although there must be specific intent that the actions be committed, not necessarily the crime, but the actions be committed. I think that's exactly mirrors what counsel just essentially conceded to. The intended conduct which resulted in the consequence, the person had to have the specific intent or the intention to commit those actions. If that is the case, then they can be applied, and it's not improper. Now, in this case, although in the briefing and in the argument, counsel has indicated that there was virtually no evidence that there was any intent on the part of Deepak Desai to enter into these actions, which ultimately caused the consequences that we all know about in this case. I specifically would point out where he is not. Well, again, the direct actor means that he's not the one who actually pushed the drug into the patient or did the transfers as is depicted on the diagram here. The direct actions were his direct sort of marching orders to his staff to do certain things in a certain way, despite the fact that that staff had given him the risks, had told him this was a risky behavior. In fact, starting on day 12, going into day 13 of trial, the direct testimony of Keith Mathis in this case was that he talked to Desai specifically about the reuse of syringes, the propofol use minimization, which meant that they had to use multiple use bottles on multiple use or multiple patients, that he specifically talked to him about the risk of using the same syringe, changing the needle, doing whatever, and Desai said this to him. He was aware of the risk. He said, "Do it anyway, it's to save money." So he's aware. Keith Mathis has just told Desai what the risk is of this practice. Desai says, "Do it anyway, it's to save money." That's directly related to the syringe reuse. Now, also, Keith Mathis mentioned that he was essentially instructed to reuse syringes and the propofol, just change the needles. Appellate record, I think that was Bates number 1937. With regard to other individuals who were instructed of, not necessarily we couldn't tie Desai being the person to do it, but Vince Neon was instructed to reuse syringes. He stated at trial that he refused to do so. Linda Hubbard They watched her do that. That's where one of the things that the CDC, not they didn't watch her, but the Clifford Carroll, who was a doctor who testified, watched her do that, and that was after the CDC had been there. So the process of this being involved, and when she was questioned about that, what did she say? She was said that Desai told her to do it like Ron did it, like Ron Lakeman, the nurse anesthetist who was also a co-defendant of Dr. Desai at the time of trial. Ron Lakeman told the CDC exactly how he did it. He used syringes, on the same bottle, then used the same bottle on the next patient. And he said that he was aware of the risk, and counsel even alluded to that in her argument, that they changed the needles or they used the negative pressure to reduce the risk. If you conform to that and say that, in fact, you're going to go forward with that behavior, you will have to be aware of risk if you're taking measures to avoid risk. Those are direct pieces of evidence that came out in the trial that showed that Dr. Desai had instructed on that particular issue. If we step back one point further, we got into the issue of biopsy forceps and snare reuse. Now, that had stopped at the time of these infections, and the reason it had stopped is because the manufacturer, when he heard of what was going on, came in and started providing the snares and biopsy forceps on a par basis, which meant that there was a certain amount paid every month, and how many ever they used, they would make sure they never ran out. It was only after that that Dr. Desai, in fact, stopped using the snares. Now the risk, and this is where we get into his knowledge of risk and his disregard of the knowledge and telling them to go forward anyway. In that particular instance, Jeff Kruger, who came in and testified, who was the nurse who was responsible for ordering things, he comes in and he says that Dr. Desai and he and Katie Bingley have had a conversation about the use of the syringe, of the biopsy forceps and the snares. And he had actually been presented, or he presented Dr. Desai with a paper that said what the risk was and why, and that we can't do this anymore. There's a risk to patients of infection. Dr. Desai agreed to acknowledge that. Then later on, what's key here is that Dr. Desai goes behind their backs directly to the GI techs, the people that are doing in the trenches the work, and he's telling them to reuse those syringes and forceps. Not the syringes, I'm sorry, the snares and the forceps. Jeff Kruger finds out about that. He comes back to Desai, and he says, what's going on? We've talked about this. And then Desai says, okay. But despite knowing the risk, despite being told of the risk and shown scientific proof that there was a problem, he tells his staff to go forward with this. Now, nobody ever came in and said that, Desai ordered that there not be enough supplies so the staff couldn't do what they were supposed to do. The whole reason that all of this testimony came out about the pressure, the atmosphere, how patients running through, that they cut corners at every chance to save time, because time was money, because time was more patients. More patients meant more reimbursement. More reimbursement meant a higher dollar amount, looking back on how the profits came into the clinic, so when Desai sold the clinic, he would be able to maximize the value of that. He went even so far as to remove one of the costliest items associated with the endoscopy center, which was the salaries for the CRNAs, and shift that over to the gastro center so that it wouldn't show up on the books. That's what he was doing at the high end. At the low end, he would go around to staff and monitor their use of items which were pennies, fractions of pennies, and berate them, incentivize them, as far as propofol was concerned, to try and reduce. So this entire pressure, and we're talking about pressure cooker from not just the patients rolling through, but the staff itself, day in and day out, rolling in. Of the patients that rolled through that door for an endoscopy procedure, from start to finish, that means bringing the patient in, hooking them up, doing the procedure, taking them down, moving them out of the room, cleaning the room, next patient rolled in, less than 10 minutes on average when Desai was there. That's what he's doing. He's rolling them through. The pressure is so high that they have to cut corners at every cost. They have to pre-chart because they can't put down the right chart numbers. Because they were under such pressure to cut corners at every cost, to save, to not be seen with a syringe that had some propofol left in it at the end of a procedure. Because of that, the use of the items decreased dramatically. Not because they were told you can only have this one syringe, but because they didn't either have time to use it or because they knew he was going to be watching and that was going to be the problem. I mean, Keith Mathis testified specifically about the side command at the beginning of the procedure on a regular basis going over to the Sharps container, which contained the syringes, the bottles of propofol, and rattling around and looking in the contaminated container to see if, in fact, there were any syringes that had any propofol left in them, to see if there were any bottles that had been discarded that had any propofol left in them. And what was his answer to what would have happened if he had seen that? He probably would have been fired. That's the kind of pressure that Desai exerted on the staff, and the reason why the reuse occurred, and the reason why this happened. Counsel's exactly right. You use a single syringe on a single bottle on a single patient, you discard everything at the end, no problem. It's only when you start moving things from one patient to another that there becomes a problem. If you're moving the propofol and you're not using multiple syringes for every time you draw in, there's a problem. And just for your edification, in 2007, which was the year that this took place, the number of propofol bottles that were ordered, 6,764. The number of patients that day at the Chateau, this is Chateau Lane, where this occurred, 14,957. 6,764 and 14,957. There was no possible way propofol was not being used patient to patient. Syringes ordered for the same year, 17,100 syringes. It could not have happened that they were doing all of the aseptic techniques to avoid infection. And the reason that they weren't doing it that way was because they were being forced by the staff or by the Desai, because no one else exerted pressure, no one else exerted any sort of control over the clinic. That was the reason why testimony came in and evidence came in about Desai being a micromanager, about him being down in the trenches, not just being up in a room generally having knowledge, because we had to prove, and I believe we should have had to prove, that he was a direct actor in the instigation and in the foundation for why and how this occurred and why these people did what
they
did.
Counselor, can I ask you a question on charging them? The other side is saying that it doesn't meet the requirements of second-degree murder through aiding and abetting. Does the state consider charging them with involuntary manslaughter or something as a lesser standard?
I think that's something that could have been done. It was not, because I think that when we looked at the conduct and how this matched up with, and I think this is a perfect case for second-degree felony murder. The second-degree felony murder is based on involvement in a felony that, you know, is an inherently dangerous act. I would submit to anyone that performing reckless acts on patients, which would subject them to any risk and not informing them of that risk, would essentially be an inherently dangerous act.
Could you address the confrontation clause arguments that are
made? Yes, I would do that. Regarding all of them, or just
yes,
certainly. With regard to the confrontation issue, the deposition, the death certificate, and the testimony of Elaine Olson.
Right.
Testimony of Elaine Olson did not rely upon the death certificate, did not rely upon the autopsy that was done in the Philippines. It relied upon her own findings. She was present. She did not perform the autopsy, but she stood right there. She watched the body open. She saw the ascites fluid pour out. She did all of the things. She obtained samples at the time. She took those samples back of the heart, lungs, liver, she needed to look at. She goes back. She does the slide. She does the samples. She looks at those. She finds that there is active inflammation and extensive inflammation of the liver at the time, because that's postmortem finding that she observed herself. So her reliance upon those things about even the death certificate, she did not rely upon it. She did not testify to that amount or to that regard. When it came to that whole issue, there was an outside-the-presence sort of exchange where she was brought into the court. She was asked what the basis of her opinions were, and not one instance did she say she relied upon any of those documents. Secondly, with regard to the death certificate. Now, counsel has kind of indicated that the death certificate was done by the person who did the autopsy. Absolutely incorrect. The death occurred on the 27th of April at about 11-something in the evening. I've got the death certificate here. At about 11-something in the evening. The attending physician who attended the death is the one who signs off on that death certificate. He does that on the 27th. It is certified on the 28th. We didn't even know in Clark County that the death had occurred at that point. So those instrumental portions of the death certificate, the things that he's certifying in the death certificate that were the cause of death, had nothing to do with an autopsy. As a matter of fact, box 20 in the autopsy report specifically, in the death certificate says, was an autopsy performed? It's marked no. Because at the time, that was not known that that was even going to happen. This is something that happened subsequently. So did the medical doctor who was attending, who signs off on the death certificate as to the cause of death, know that this was going into litigation, that this was something that he had to do in anticipation of litigation? No. So in those instances, there's no confrontation issue. The case that was cited to Burkhead, and then later, I guess, we go to Beecham over the Mississippi Supreme Court came back and said, well, can't use a death certificate in that case. It's completely distinguishable from the facts in this particular case. In that instance, it was a DUI case. The 77-year-old woman dies 6 weeks after injury at the hospital. At that trial, they introduced not a single bit of evidence, none, medical evidence, showing what caused the death except for giving the death certificate. The court said that was inappropriate, that unless there was supporting evidence, some sort of background or foundational information, that you could not use that death certificate in that way in that instance. Here, there was a plethora of medical information that we had the medical records, we had the primary care doctor that was involved, we had the testimony from Elaine Olson, which did not rely upon those things. We had the medical records 2 weeks before going to the Philippines, which showed that he had active hepatitis C. She did not rely upon that. The one thing I wasn't able to get to was, I believe, her testimony, but I'll defer.
Chief, could I ask one more question?
Of course.
Did Dr. Tsai ask for a lesser included instruction on involuntary manslaughter?
Specifically, that did come up at trial, and he did not ask for a lesser included on involuntary manslaughter.
What about the deposition?
The deposition issue, I'm sorry, because I wasn't able to get to that. Thank you. The deposition issue was this. At the time that deposition occurred, the reason that we were doing the deposition was because at that point, we were coming up to trial. Mr. Medina's condition had deteriorated markedly. We became aware of the fact that he was not probably going to make it to trial. That, in fact, if we didn't do something soon, he was on his way back to the Philippines. That he was basically, in a couple of weeks, was going to go to the Philippines, and the whole purpose of that was for him to get to his home country to die. Everybody was aware of his fragile health status at the time. Everybody was aware that he was likely to be unavailable at trial. So when we go in there to do the deposition, everybody's aware of this. It's litigated pre-trial. We go in there, we do it. At the point where Richard Wright is not allowed to go forward because he couldn't because of the medical issues, we still go forward for a period of time thereafter. But he wasn't able to effectively, he claimed, do anything with certain questions he wanted to ask, even knowing what the parameters were for his cross-examination. And again, it doesn't mean that it has to be exhaustive to the extent that they want. Here's the key part of this, is that one of the things the state, in trying to admit the deposition, wanted to admit not only that we did at the video deposition related to the criminal case, but a deposition that had been done a few months before in the civil case where the same issues of his health status and so forth had been fleshed out. They opposed that. It never got into court. However, at the time of trial, because Richard Wright had come in and said that he was unable to question Mr. Medina about certain aspects of his rejection of interferon therapy, he asked that portions, and he said specific portions of a section of the transcript from the civil side, be allowed to read that into the record. It was Exhibit 1BB at the time of trial, and he was allowed to do that. Now, our point at that time was, we didn't object to that. We just wanted the entirety of that exchange brought in. The court said, no, he was the one who wanted to have certain pieces of information come in. Maybe he didn't want to ask these other questions. We're going to let him take the excerpted portions from the transcript that he wishes to have put in. So he was able to augment his sort of deposition questioning with portions that he felt were important, which were specifically aimed at the fact that Mr. Miena had at one point stopped interferon therapy, did not continue with it, and that was his contention, that was the supervening intervening cause, that his failure to complete treatment in some way, you know, broke up that causal connection. All of that was brought out at trial. It was litigated, and he was able to bring in any portion. The court made it indicated at the time that basically whatever he wanted to bring in, she was going to allow him to bring in, and she did so. And I'm talking about the judge in the case.
Okay, any other questions?
There was one additional. A question was asked previously as to jeopardy and jeopardy attaching for purposes if a retrial was possible. What's your position as to that?
Jeopardy in what way? In terms of the fact that he's been tried and, well, I would submit that basically, there is no jeopardy argument in this case. The whole issue with even looking at the second-degree felony murder portion of this, where they were talking about the underlying felony, that somehow that should merge, and this court has recently, as of February of this year, come forward and indicated that those things don't match. I think Justice Cherry was the author of the opinion in Gettings. That was also one where we talked about the elements of second-degree felony murder, and still the court says the two elements are the two elements that were brought forth in this case, the instructions that have always been brought forth in the cases where those cases have come before the Supreme Court. There's no third element that the court has ever come back and said has to be included. So basically, at this point, I don't think that there is a double jeopardy argument if there was a retrial, because there's nothing that would preclude it. There was nothing that happened, has happened subsequently, that would preclude going back and retrying the issues at this point.
So if this court were to reverse on the second-degree murder, did I just hear you say that that could be retried?
On the second-degree murder? I believe that if the court were to reverse, unless the court said that it was inappropriate, maybe I'm misunderstanding. If the court were to come back and say that it's inappropriate that the merger, for example, should have occurred, something like that. And again, the court really in Rose, and I think that's what you're alluding to, is the assaulted elements issue. The court said that if the underlying felonies have assaulted elements, then there should be or should have been an instruction as to whether or not it was something that the jury had to go through that analysis as to whether it was an assaulted felony or not. Now, did the felonies have assaulted elements? No. There's no reasonable jury that could ever come forward to determine that the conduct constituting patient neglect or criminal neglect of patients and performance of an act in reckless disregard, that those predicate felonies were in any way had enough assaulted elements which would indicate an immediate threat of violent injury. But the fact that you have, and that's what Rose said, the underlying felonies have those elements, assaultive elements, and they defined assaultive elements as the threat of immediate violent injury, that then the jury has to be instructed on it. Because there's not even the leanest stretch that you can imagine, which would indicate that the underlying predicate felonies in this case have assaultive elements by that definition, then it would be harmless if at all, if the court was to require that the juries be instructed on that, because they could not come back and find it, I believe, based on the evidence and facts that came forward in the case.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, we don't have a whole lot of time, so I just want to get one quick question. The state said that you did not request a lesser-included instruction of involuntary manslaughter. I realize that's your option, but do you have any thoughts on that?
The thing is that there is a statute that covers this conduct that provides for a penalty for neglect of patient if the patient dies, and the legislature has determined what the penalty is. And so the lesser option of involuntary manslaughter doesn't really, that's why they didn't charge it. They didn't like the penalty, okay? And that's why they charged second-degree felony murder, because they didn't like the penalty that the legislature has selected for neglect.
You could have asked for the lesser.
We could have. We didn't, okay? What occurred at the trial just occurred in front of you. What you heard was that Keith Mathis explained to Dr. Desai about this combination of practices, and that Dr. Desai said, go ahead and do it to save money. Let me read to you from Volume 7, 1693, Keith Mathis's testimony. The police officer is, the prosecutor is asking this question. You open the bottle propofol, you draw the medication, and you take that syringe needle combination, and you go into the hep lock, and you administer medication to the patient. Are you following me so far? Did you ever take that syringe and go back into the bottle of propofol? And then he explains. Nowhere in there was there ever a suggestion that he told Dr. Desai, because right after that is the part that counsel has referred to, which is I told Dr. Desai about it, I said there was a risk, and he said keep doing it. This is what he was explaining on page 1693 of Volume 7, and it's the weakness of a syringe on a patient, and right after that he responds, and I've been doing this for 33 years. And that happened at trial. If we were talking about infection being transferred because of biopsy forceps, I wouldn't be making this same argument. But because the trial court judge found that there was a paucity of evidence that Dr. Desai ever directed anybody to do the conduct that actually resulted in the infection, which is what this indictment is about. It is not about some vague, atmospheric, you know, lots of bad practices in a clinic case. It is about specific conduct, and we have to hold to that in criminal law. Otherwise, the danger, as this court has repeated at least three or four times, of an untoward prosecution is present. I might say that I represented in my brief that the third Morris element, that there must be some conduct beyond simple commission of the felony in order to be one of the protections with regard to second-degree felony murder, had not been mentioned again. It had. When I reread Rose this morning, footnote number 2 lists all three elements. And in this case, where it really mattered, there was no instruction, it must be examined under a plain error standard, but just as in Ramirez, it would require reversal of the second-degree felony.
Could I continue with the same section of the testimony of Tass, or however you pronounce
Mathis,
that?
Mathis, yeah,
sorry. The state, did Desai instruct you to use syringes with propofol remaining in them on another patient? No, I never heard that. He never asked you to do that? No. What about the bottles of propofol? If you hadn't used a whole bottle of propofol on one patient, did he ever tell you to save that and use it on the next patient? That was just common practice, is the answer. That's the way it was done. Okay, everybody did it that way, the state's question? Mathis, that's what we were instructed to do, yes. Instructed by whom? Dr. Desai.
And I'm glad you asked that question, because Dorothy Sims, who was part of the investigation team from the health department, came in and observed Hubbard, Maione, and Sagendorf, three nurse anesthetists. She observed them doing what they did, which tells you there was no overall directive, because what they did, and which everybody testified would not result in infection, was they pre-filled syringes. So yes, they would come in the morning, there's testimony, and I've laid it out in the charts there at the back of my opening brief. They come in the morning, and they lay out 10 or 15 pre-filled syringes so that they can move between each of the things, so they might use two or three different bottles. But it's pre-filled syringes. So therefore, and under that circumstance, every single expert, the CDC people came in and said, well, we would like for you to do something else, but Dorothy Sims was standing there and said and testified that what she observed was perfectly safe, and she had no reason to believe that it was unsafe, and so therefore she didn't say anything to anybody because she didn't see it as risky.
Could you comment on this additional testimony by Mathis? state, would you ever use a syringe that you had used on one patient on another patient, Mathis? Never. To your knowledge, did you ever do that? No. Same question, but now something else with bottle themselves. Did you ever have bottles of propofol that you had used on one patient that you then used on another patient? Yes. And that was under the direction of Dr. Desai, if I think I understand you. Yes. Now, third scenario, did you ever have a bottle of propofol that you had to re-enter on the same patient? Yes. Now, in that situation, if you needed to redose the patient with some additional propofol and you didn't have the remaining in your syringe that you had used, did you ever take that syringe and go back into the bottle of propofol? Will you take the needle off and put on a new needle and then re-enter with the same syringe into the bottle and draw up again? That was common practice. That was common practice.
It was common practice for him. It was clearly not common practice for anyone other than Mathis and Lakeman.
But there's this remaining two questions. Were you instructed to do that? Yes. By whom? Dr. Desai.
And which he retracted, and which he retracted later. Because there never was any testimony about how did Dr. Desai know that he was. That's the gap. That's why they have to talk to you about cost of supplies. I absolutely have to tell you this, is that what happened here with this prosecutor, when he starts talking to you about the number of syringes and the amount of propofol, their brief of pages 43 and 44, that's where those numbers come from. That is all testimony of a police officer who put together a chart that the judge said all of those conclusions must be stricken. And yet the prosecutor comes back in and does the same thing that he tried to do with that witness in front of you.
That wasn't admitted into evidence.
The chart was, but the conclusions that he's drawing about how there couldn't have been enough, syringes, there couldn't have been enough propofol.
Did it go to the jury if it was admitted into evidence?
The chart went to the jury, yeah.
So, I guess the judge let them consider the chart.
But she instructed them not to disregard any conclusions because Detective Whiteley got up on the stand and said the chart is wrong. He said it's wrong because there are thousands of bottles of propofol that are not accounted for. And so when he was asked, and it's in my brief, he said, the chart is wrong.
Okay, any additional questions? All right, thank you. The case will stand.